Today's October 24th, 2019, and this is Sarah Desick interviewing Gail Harris for the New York Preservation Archive Project. Could you just start by saying your name and giving yourself a brief introduction?
I'm Gail Harris. I'm used to work at the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission. I retired in 2017. Currently, I'm working as a consultant for the NYC LGBT Historic Sites Project, doing research on outer borough sites, which is done several in Brooklyn, and now working on ones in Staten Island.
Thanks. Can you tell me a little bit about the place where you grew up?
I grew up in Philadelphia. In Winfield, which is sort of at the northwest edge of the city. I lived near City Line Avenue, so it was close to the suburbs. And I went to Penn State. I knew I wanted to be an art historian when I was in high school. I majored in art history. Initially planning on specializing in Italian Renaissance and Baroque. And my senior year, I got asked to be part of the Soho project that documented Soho. And so I went an extra term. We were on the term system, so I was here for the summer of 70, and anyhow, I was in the Soho project, and I so liked fell in love with the architecture of New York and doing research in New York City. And so then I switched to, went to graduate school working with Winston Wiseman, who was a specialist in 19th century New York architecture, and ended up studying 19th century architecture. Dr. Wiseman retired. I looked around for a program. Started it, the PhD program in Delaware. And then there were a whole bunch of family emergencies, and I couldn't finish my degree, and I ended up working for a brokerage firm for a while. And then a friend, I got together with friends for a Preservation League of New York meeting, and Gina Kellerman, who had been the first director of research at the Landmarks Commission, had been a graduate student at Penn State with me and had been working with Dr. Wiseman. She had been sort of the project manager for the Soho project. And she, I had been working on William Schickel. I wanted to I had proposed that they designate the Century Building, which is the building that Barnes & Noble is in on Union Square, and I had sort of gotten a turndown letter on that. And so I said, Gina, would you introduce me to her? I want to sort of put in a plea. And as I was talking about the surviving, all that wonderful surviving detail, and that it had, still had its original storefronts, etc., Gina said, you know, you really should bring Gail to New York. She'd be wonderful. And so Lenore Norman, who was then the executive director of the commission, said, well, you could send a resume, and I did. And I didn't expect that anything would happen, but about 6 months later, the commission contacted me and said they were actually interviewing. And then I got the job because Barry Bergdahl, who had been with the commission and had gone back to Columbia, decided that he wanted to stay teaching at Columbia, which probably was a very good decision for him. And I was sort of their second choice, so I got the job.
Wow. I want to go back a little bit and kind of understand a little bit more about Winfield and what it was like at the time. You said it was close to the suburbs, so can you explain that kind of line, what that looked like from a kind of architectural standpoint?
Well, Winfield had a lot of interesting sort of I lived in what's was called you know, like a twin, which was one, you know, that was post-war, but there were a lot of large 1920s and earlier sort of single family houses. It was sort of suburban in its in a way. There was one sort of maybe 17th, 18th, the Wynn Mansion survived in the neighborhood, but there was a lot of historic architecture. So I grew up with historic architecture. I can also remember growing up in Philadelphia and riding around City Hall and thinking that it was the most magical building in the world, just sort of being in the back seat and falling in love with that building. And I was one of those people that was always interested in history, and even as a teenager, I used to go on, like when they had Germantown Day and you could go tour historic houses in Germantown, or I used to like to go tour the historic houses in Fairmount Park, which was fairly close to Winfield also. So it was sort of, I grew up interested in historic architecture from a young age. It was sort of a good fit for me.
And the art history interest, can you explain that as well, and the relationship of your art history interest to the architecture history?
Oh, well, it you start by studying cultures all together. And so when I was in high school, I the first time I went to the Philadelphia Museum, I went with a friend who was from New York and went to a fancy private school, and she had to do a paper. And we went to the Philadelphia Art Museum, and I suddenly knew I was home. And so it sort of like for all my teen years, I would routinely ask for a membership in the museum as my birthday present for the year. And I used to. I just was interested in art history, and so you're studying sort of like so it just makes sense to be interested in painting and sculpture and architecture, because it's, you know, you're studying cultures and their various manifestations.
Do you remember any artworks in particular at the Philadelphia Museum?
Of course.
I mean one that really got you. Too broad of a question, I'm sorry. Yeah. I asked because I grew up outside of Philadelphia and have a similar story. Mm-hmm. So.
It's a common, I love their period rooms, and I love Cezanne, and they have some knock your socks off Cezannes. And then they have just some wonderful, wonderful paintings. Whether it's their Italian Renaissance stuff, they just have terrific things.
I think for me it was Cy Twombly and thinking, wow, what is this?
Well, it was also like one of the things I did one summer was I did like this thing for members where this was like between the summer between 11th and 12th grade. They had a thing where you could sort of take classes in art appreciation, and we were going through the modern stuff, and I guess we were looking at a Brancusi bird, and I sort of expounded on that it was the essence of streamlining and flight, and I realized I'm good at this. Oh, it was also, I was interested in historic costume and originally thought I was going to be a costume curator. And I, while I was in high school, I went to talk to someone on staff at the museum, and they explained that you didn't start with a specialty like that. You majored in art history and then you specialized. So I had already gotten some advice, and it was that I applied to Penn State because my parents didn't have a lot of money, so it was, I was going to be going to one of the either Penn State or Temple or the University of Pittsburgh. Those were the three places I applied as an undergraduate. Then as I started taking courses, my interests changed over the years.
Can you talk in a little more detail about what you did on the SOHO project?
The first thing that we did was to go to the buildings department, and we started reading the block and lot folders for the buildings. So Gina sort of taught us how, you know, go through the block and lot folders, read the permits, transcribe the information. For the project, they were pulling the drawings. In some cases, they were actually had to humidify the drawings to the point because, or the permits, because the paper was so brittle. So we created this humidification chamber that was one of the metal lockers where they sort of plugged up all the holes and put a bucket of water. Wow. You left the plans for a day or two in this thing, and then they were pliant enough that you could open them up. And so we had sort of this little room that we'd sit in and eat. We'd be going through the drawings. We had the interesting discovery that several of the streets in SoHo had been renumbered, and which we didn't discover till several weeks into the project. And that meant that the information that we had taken down had to be readjusted because it was for the wrong building. Then when we got through going through the block and lot folders, there were a series of buildings for which we hadn't found any information in terms of new building information. And so Gina taught some of us how to do tax record research so that you might be able to come up with an estimate on the dates. I might say that, you know, it sort of like Gina had already been the director of research at Landmarks, was concerned that the commission was just looking at doing only two streets, doing Broome Street and Broadway, and not the entirety of SoHo, because, and she was very anxious that all of SoHo, or as much as possible, be designated. She had gotten, I guess Dr. Weissman may have figured out that they could apply. There was no such thing as the National Endowment for the Arts or the National Endowment for the Humanities. They applied for a grant from the National Endowment for the Sciences, and they had to incorporate sociologists. So we were supposedly studying architecture, sociology, and several other things, so we could get the grant from the National Science Foundation. Though, of course, the idea was, behind it all, was to have all this documentation to sort of present to the Landmarks Commission so they would have no choice but to designated a bigger area, and it worked.
Well, I guess I'd like to ask you now to start talking about your time at LPC, and And I want to know also about your involvement with the union. So however it makes sense for you to kind of get into this topic, please.
Okay. So I started working for Landmarks in December of 1984. And my first project was a cast iron fronted building on Canal Street. So it was drawing on sort of the information or my background in working in cast iron buildings in Soho. And soon after I did that, there were a couple of things that I worked on that didn't go anywhere, and then I got pulled into working on the Broadway theaters, and I worked on theater histories for like a year or so with a couple of designated. I got to work on they did decide to do the Century Building, and I got to write that designation report, but it was mostly that I was working on Broadway theaters for the first part of my career, and that was interesting and drew on all the time I had wasted time watching old movies instead of working on studying for my courses at college.
I like when those things overlap.
Yes. So anyhow, Jay Shockley had been involved with the union. I guess there are two things that I went to my first union meeting, or two, and at one of them, people were complaining about the lack of equipment. And that they had tried to, they had asked for new cameras and additional typewriters. This long, 1985. And Janet O'Hare, who was then the chapter president, saw a sucker in me and said, Gail, why don't you go ask the executive director where we stand on this? And I don't know why I agreed to do this, but I did. And so I sort of wrote a little note and said, I have been asked to, you know, talk to you about this. Can I come up to see you? So went to see Lenore Norman, the executive director, and I started to ask about this, getting the equipment. And Lenore said, Gail, you're a good girl. And I know there are just a few troublemakers there. Who are they? And I answered, well, it was the consensus of the group that we needed this equipment. And so where do we stand on getting the equipment? This made me realize that they did need a union. And then, I guess, Jay was already sort of involved in the union, and he got me to go to the first delegates meeting with him. And I went, so I used to participate a little bit, and then and Jay followed Janet O'Hare as the chapter president, and they were looking for somebody, and I thought I might be interested in doing it. And then I was the chapter president. Well, I'm still the chapter president, but I get to give it up next in 2 weeks.
But when did you become the chapter president?
In the late 1980s, so I've been chapter president for over 30 years. It was hard to find a successor. No, it was hard for me to give it up, and it was hard for to find anybody that would take it on, but it looks like I have some people now, which is a good thing, because I'm retired and cannot continue.
What sort of things did you do as the chapter president? I mean, what is that role like at for LPC?
In a sort of constant asking for stuff, for more money, for they constantly understaffed the preservation department. And the city does not take care of its buildings very well, and so people work in conditions which, you know, are grubby, and so we constantly have health and safety stuff, which in some cases I've succeeded in interceding for people, and in terms of when they'll get the rules wrong on things like how much time you get for leaves. They'll try and fire people without going through the grievance process, etc. So, it's frustrating because you never achieve what you like to achieve, but if you didn't do it, things would be worse. So I've hung in there over the years and tried to do what I could. Had, you know, been involved in the politics of the union, and so there was the camaraderie of that and the great struggles of that, etc. So,
having been the chapter president for so long, can you speak to any changes that you've seen, I guess, either among the staff or the function of the union?
I think that perhaps when they first got the union, The union was had already been established from some years when I started. And when they first organized, it was to get benefits because the people, the salaries had been incredibly low. It was sort of like people were, it was the first people, especially in the research department, were often supposed to be sort of the wives of successful businessmen. And it was like, they used to share phones, and so people always got colds. There wasn't really enough room. People often worked at home because people shared desks. And it wasn't particularly professional, and it wasn't looked on as a profession. So the first thing that they organized for was more pay and to have the benefits in terms of sick leave and prescription plan that the unionized workers had. And because there were certain things you got as a city worker, but you got more if you were in the union. In over the years, it's like preservation has become an actual profession where there are schools and you study preservation. There are still more women than men, but there are more men and there are more straight men. So there's more demand for better salaries, which the commission still doesn't meet as well as it should. It's like, they still think, the people that run the commission still think of themselves as being sort of fluff and vulnerable, and so they're not as willing to fight for money, especially if it sometimes I think managerial salaries have gone up a lot, but staff salaries are not commensurate, say, with what the people that work for the buildings department make. Though it's probably work is in some ways more specialized in preservation.
Yeah.
And so that's still like an outstanding problem that I've tried to bring up, but I don't think has been addressed as well as I'd like to see it. It's sort of like there's still not enough of a career path that people can really, because the commission's still pretty small, there's not enough place for all the people that to sort of stay there, build up their expertise, and be able to stay.
Makes sense.
That's a problem that people from other agencies don't have. And been one of the big frustrations of trying to do this. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask about when you first moved to the city, where were you living?
The first place I lived was a share at Riverside Drive and Tiemann's Place, up by Columbia. It was, I liked living in that neighborhood, and it was certainly convenient for getting to work. It was, the building was sort of like, had been rent controlled. The owner was trying to convert it to a co-op. My roommate and I were subletting from the woman that had been my roommate's friend. My roommate was an art, a sculptor, and she was subletting from a woman ceramicist who Margie and her husband wanted to buy a place upstate, and so they had moved out of the apartment and were living upstate, and eventually they decided that they would take money from the landlord not to renew the lease. And so then I ended up moving to, I wanted my own apartment, and so then I ended up moving to the apartment I'm still living in Bay Ridge. So I've only lived two places in New York.
That's rare. why Bay Ridge?
I wanted to live in Park Slope. And I looked in Park Slope so this is like 1986 that I'm looking for an apartment. I was already sort of priced out of Park. You know, everything I looked at was weird in some way, or I couldn't afford it. There was one woman that was living in Sunset Park. And so I figured, well, I'll get on. I had looked in an apartment in Park Slope, and I figured, I'll get on the Fifth Avenue bus, and I'll take the bus to Sunset Park, and I'll see where it looks safe and like I might want to live there, and I'll get out of the bus. And all the way through Sunset Park, I didn't realize that you really needed to be over at 8th Avenue. 5th Avenue bus was not. And I ended up in Bay Ridge, and it looked really nice. And I started going to real estate places, and I could afford the apartments in Bay Ridge as long as I didn't want to live on Shore Road. It just was a lot more affordable, and that's why I ended up there. Mm-hmm. And it was relatively close to Lower Manhattan. Of course, then they started working on the Manhattan Bridge and the subway stop going express, but.
And you had said before that you were, when you were working on the Soho project, how you realized how much you loved, you know, working on this stuff in New York. So what was it about New York City architecture history and city history that you loved so much?
It seemed, I guess I like cities. I don't drive. So that was a natural. Soho just had all these wonderful, beautiful buildings. I mean, there's just amazing architectural details all over the city. It's like, we're talking about the 70s and the 80s, and I guess everybody, there was this collective falling in love with the city, even at a time when the city's financial state wasn't so great. But when you think about those Woody Allen, you know, like Manhattan, when Woody Allen takes you on this tour of all the interesting architectural bits, and he's showing these to Diane Keaton, then it really turns out that she's the one that's interested in architecture. She's the one that's on the board of the National. It's just interesting. Also, when I had been, when I was working on my thesis, and I was, you know, used to sort of sit and read the architectural records and the AABN and the Real Estate Record and Guide. I just liked doing the research. I just liked doing research a lot. I like libraries. I like, you know, it's a natural for me.
And I wanted to ask about, I guess, when did you start to realize that gay and lesbian history was not part of what you were doing at the Landmarks Commission, or that it wasn't being presented in the same way as other kinds of cultural history?
I think it wasn't so much thinking about whether you include, the first thing that happened was that I was working on the Lundy's designation report, and I found this article about Lundy having been bilked out of all this money because his boyfriend was in this conspiracy with other people, and one of them had dressed up as Lundy, and they had gone to the bank and sort of taken stuff out of the safe deposit box and had, so it was like, the thing was, it was the largest instance of personal fraud or whatever it was, larceny, in the history in New York State up until that point. And so I put that into the body of the designation report in the section that was sort of later history. And uh, Dorothy Miner sort of thought it might upset Mundy's family that still owned the building. And so it was sort of like it had to go into a footnote because she didn't want it as something that would create a conflict. And then, of course, the family came in for a meeting with Lundy's lawyer, who is the one that talked about the chauffeur having been also, had actually said in an interview in, I think it was probably Newsday, that the guy had been Lundy's lover. So they come in for this meeting, and guess who just got out of jail? The lover. So it's like, but by this time, the report was already, yeah. pretty much final, so that was.
As a researcher, you know, how do you go about making decisions about what might upset someone versus what is the history?
That was... I think I didn't think about it as something that would potentially upset. Though it's sort of like at the commission, you still, one, you're trying to be celebratory as much as possible, while still being true to history. I think it. I probably, you know, I also sometimes would not, you know, have things be confrontational, but still in all, you want to do justice to history. It's all of these things are difficult things to achieve. Certainly, I think over the years, the trend has been to trying to be more inclusive of more groups, and that still in all there are parts of there are groups in New York City that aren't really represented in terms of what the commission does. Sometimes that, you know, there's been a push for African American history for quite a while now. we've sort of pushed for gay and lesbian history. The commission sort of tried to address Latino history. I guess it's Latinx now. But it certainly hasn't gone very much in depth. And then we really haven't done anything, say, about Asians. We have one thing for Arabs, and it's a Christian church.
So it's a bigger issue than just gay. It's just been history.
Yeah. But certainly, both Jay especially, Jay Shockley especially, tried, and well, there was, I guess, when we got involved with OGAD, the members of OGAD felt like we wanted to see LGBT history recognized and documented.
That's where this idea started to coalesce.
Yeah, I think it was sort of like both Jay and I had been involved with forming a gay and lesbian group in our union in DC 37. And that had gotten off the ground, and we were sort of like had done our bit in that, and other people had taken over, and we needed something to do. And OGAD formed. And then within OGAD, there were a whole bunch of people that were in preservation. And so we decided that we started meeting in people's apartments separately.
Were you part of forming OGAD?
I wasn't part of forming OGAD. I got involved sort of early on when they were having but it was already formed and they were having meetings in the center. And then I guess some people decided that we would start, that there'd be a group that would be preservation, the preservation group. So we started, as I said, it was like we met, there were meetings at Bill Ayer's apartment and some other people's apartments. And we started talking about what buildings were most significant, what were the most significant things that should be sort of recognized, that we, and of course, the Stonewall seemed to be the most obvious thing. Then there were a whole bunch of people in that group that worked for the Park Service. They couldn't really ask for National Register, recognition if they were Park Service employees. I had just worked on the African burial ground, so I had experience working on National Historic Landmarks. nomination.
About how big was, I guess, OLGAD as a whole, and then the preservation group?
OLGAD was attracting like over 100 people to its meetings. And then there were, and I didn't know if you had.
I don't, but yeah, so.
Well, that's the infamous map. I will try, I have nicer ones, but I found that sort of lying someplace. So I took that, brought that one.
Nice.
I could find, it was actually on the floor. So anyhow.
Yeah, I haven't seen the original one yet. I've just seen the updated kind of digital version.
Yeah, so.
So I want to ask you about, you know, to talk further about the National Register nomination, and but also let's maybe, if you could talk about the sites that were selected for this map. How did, you know, talk a little bit more about how that came together, you know, how you kind of nominated them within the group and made decisions. And
okay, well, so then
how the work got divided.
We formed a committee to, within the sort of preservationist committee. We formed a map committee. We formed a committee to nominate the Stonewall for designation. I think those were the things we originally thought. We didn't just think we wanted to do a map. We thought we wanted to do a guidebook. reality sinks in. And I guess, and I guess there were people, there were some people that sort of were doing, you know, did lectures and things like that for the big meetings that they would have. And, So the map committee, you had two groups in the map committee. There were the people that were the historians that sort of decided, some of whom worked for the Landmarks Commission. Well, let's see. Here's the list of people. And okay, so we had people that did were gonna do wrote the history, so then we decided. It was sort of like the money was coming from Ruth Messenger's office. So we were doing Manhattan. And the village was richest in, wanted to do Harlem so that you would get some African American sites. And then some sort of like important places in Manhattan. So then we, I guess, we made, came up with huge lists. I started reading about some stuff. And then we sort of whittled down our lists to things that everybody sort of could agree would be interesting. And then it was like Joan Berkowitz and Mary Jablonski were doing Harlem. So they pretty much came up with their sites. This was, they were still working for the Park Service, but they were sort of like best buddies at that point. So they took Harlem, and then Tom Reynolds like was supposed to, was doing musical stuff. I did like the center and Stonewall, because I was writing the Stonewall nomination, and I, Mary Hall, and so then each of us did our sites. Jay did the theater thing, and Andrew Durkart, offered to be the editor because he felt there should be one editorial voice that would sort of keep things consistent. So he didn't write entries, he just edited everything. And then there were the fights between the historian. It was sort of like, then you had the people that were in charge of doing the design. And the design people wanted us, wanted the text immediately. And then they took forever with the design, and then we were really unhappy with the fact that they decided to put the text on top of the maps, which, and so there are always all these conflicts.
Sure.
But